Chapter 7. That the truth of reason is not in opposition to the truth of the Christian faith. Now though the aforesaid truth of the Christian faith surpasses the ability of human reason, nevertheless those things which are naturally instilled in human reason cannot be opposed to this truth, for it is clear that those things which are implanted in reason by nature, are most true, so much so that it is impossible to think them to be false. Nor is it lawful to deem false that which is held by faith, since it is so evidently confirmed by God. Seeing then that the false alone is opposed to the true, as evidently appears if we examine their definitions, it is impossible for the aforesaid truth of faith to be contrary to those principles which reason knows naturally. Again, the same thing which the disciple's mind receives from its teacher is contained in the knowledge of the teacher, unless he teach insincerely, which it were wicked to say of God. Now the knowledge of naturally known principles is instilled into us by God, since God Himself is the author of our nature. Therefore the divine wisdom also contains these principles. Consequently whatever is contrary to these principles, is contrary to the divine wisdom, wherefore it cannot be from God. Therefore those things which are received by faith from divine revelation cannot be contrary to our natural knowledge. Moreover, our intellect is stayed by contrary arguments, so that it cannot advance to the knowledge of truth. Wherefore if conflicting knowledges were instilled into us by God, our intellect would thereby be hindered from knowing the truth, and this cannot be ascribed to God. Furthermore, things that are natural are unchangeable so long as nature remains. Now contrary opinions cannot be together in the same subject. Therefore God does not instill into man any opinion or belief contrary to natural knowledge. Hence the Apostle says, Romans 10:8, the word is nigh thee even in thy heart and in thy mouth. This is the word of faith which we preach, yet because it surpasses reason some look upon it as though it were contrary thereto, which is impossible. This is confirmed also by the authority of Augustine, who says that which truth shall make known can no wise be in opposition to the holy books, whether of the Old or of the New Testament. From this we may evidently conclude that whatever arguments are alleged against the teachings of faith, they do not rightly proceed from the first self-evident principles instilled by nature. Wherefore they lack the force of demonstration, and are either probable or sophistical arguments, and consequently it is possible to solve them. Chapter 8. In what relation human reason stands to the truth of faith? It would also seem well to observe that sensible things from which human reason derives the source of its knowledge, retain a certain trace of likeness to God, but so imperfect that it proves altogether inadequate to manifest the substance itself of God. For effects resemble their causes according to their own mode, since like action proceeds from like agent, and yet the effect does not always reach to a perfect likeness to the agent. Accordingly human reason is adapted to the knowledge of the truth of faith, which can be known in the highest degree only by those who see the divine substance, in so far as it is able to put together certain probable arguments in support thereof, which nevertheless are insufficient to enable us to understand the aforesaid truth as though it were demonstrated to us or understood by us in itself. And yet however weak these arguments may be, it is useful for the human mind to be practiced therein, so long as it does not pride itself on having comprehended or demonstrated, since although our view of the sublimest things is limited and weak, it is most pleasant to be able to catch but a glimpse of them, as appears from what has been said. The authority of Hilary is in agreement with this statement, for he says, while speaking of this same truth, begin by believing these things, advance and persevere, and though I know thou wilt not arrive, I shall rejoice at thy advance. For he who devoutly follows in pursuit of the infinite, though he never come up with it, will always advance by setting forth. Yet pry not into that secret, and meddle not in the mystery of the birth of the infinite, nor presume to grasp that which is the summit of understanding, but understand that there are things thou canst not grasp. Chapter 9. Of the order and mode of procedure in this work. Accordingly, From what we have been saying, it is evident that the intention of the wise man must be directed to the twofold truth of divine things and to the refutation of contrary errors, and that the research of reason is able to reach to one of these, while the other surpasses every effort of reason. And I speak of a twofold truth of divine things, not on the part of God Himself, who is truth one and simple, but on the part of our knowledge, the relation of which to the knowledge of divine things varies. Wherefore, in order to deduce the first kind of truth, we must proceed by demonstrative arguments whereby we can convince our adversaries. But since such arguments are not available in support of the second kind of truth, our intention must be not to convince our opponent by our arguments, but to solve the arguments which he brings against the truth, because, as shown above, natural reason cannot be opposed to the truth of faith. In a special way may the opponent of this kind of truth be convinced by the authority of Scripture confirmed by God with miracles, since we believe not what is above human reason save because God has revealed it. In support, however, of this kind of truth, certain probable arguments must be adduced for the practice and help of the faithful, but not for the conviction of our opponents, because the very insufficiency of these arguments would rather confirm them in their error, if they thought that we assented to the truth of faith on account of such weak reasonings. With the intention then of proceeding in the manner laid down, we shall first of all endeavor to declare the truth which is the object of faith's confession and of reason's researches, by adducing arguments both demonstrative and probable, some of which we have gathered from the writings of the philosophers and of holy men, so as thereby to confirm the truth and convince our opponents. After this, so as to proceed from the more to the less manifest, we shall with God's help proceed to declare the truth which surpasses reason, by refuting the arguments of our opponents, and by setting forth the truth of faith by means of probable arguments and authority. Seeing then that we intend by the way of reason to pursue those things about God which human reason is able to investigate, the first object that offers itself to our consideration consists in those things which pertain to God in Himself; the second, will be the procession of creatures from Him; and the third, the relation of creatures to Him as their end. Of those things which we need to consider about God in Himself, we must give the first place, this being the necessary foundation of the whole of this work, to the question of demonstrating that there is a God, for unless this be established, all questions about divine things are out of court. Chapter 10. Of the opinion of those who aver that it cannot be demonstrated that there is a God, since this is self-evident. Possibly it will seem to some that it is useless to endeavor to show that there is a God. They say that it is self-evident that God is, so that it is impossible to think the contrary, and thus it cannot be demonstrated that there is a God. The reasons for this view are as follow. Those things are said to be self-evident which are known as soon as the terms are known. Thus, as soon as it is known what is a whole, and what is a part, it is known that the whole is greater than its part. Now such is the statement God is. For by this word God we understand a thing a greater than which cannot be thought of. This is what a man conceives in his mind when he hears and understands this word God, so that God must already be at least in his mind. Nor can he be in the mind alone, for that which is both in the mind and in reality is greater than that which is in the mind only, and the very signification of the word shows that nothing is greater than God. Wherefore it follows that it is self-evident that God is, since it is made clear from the very signification of the word. Again, it is possible to think that there is a thing which cannot be thought not to exist, and such a thing is evidently greater than that which can be thought not to exist. Therefore, if God can be thought not to exist, it follows that something can be thought greater than God, and this is contrary to the signification of the term. Therefore it remains that it is self-evident that God is. Further, those propositions are most evident in which the self-same thing is predicated of itself, for instance man is man, or wherein the predicate is included in the definition of the subject, for instance man is an animal. Now, as we shall show further on, in God alone do we find that His being is His essence, as though the same were the answer to the question, what is He? As to the question, is He? Accordingly, when we say, God is, the predicate is either identified with the subject, or at least is included in the definition of the subject, and thus it will be self-evident that God is. Moreover, things that are known naturally are self-evident, for it is not by a process of research that they become evident. Now it is naturally known that God is, since man's desire tends naturally to God as his last end, as we shall show further on. Therefore it is self-evident that God is. Again, that whereby all things are known must needs be self-evident. Now such is God, for just as the light of the sun is the principle of all visual perception, so the divine light is the principle of all intellectual knowledge, because it is therein that first and foremost intellectual light is to be found. Therefore it must needs be self-evident that God is. On account of these and like arguments, some are of opinion that it is so self-evident that God is, that it is impossible for the mind to think the contrary. Chapter 11. Refutation of the foregoing opinion and solution of the aforesaid arguments. The foregoing opinion arose from their being accustomed from the beginning to hear and call upon the name of God. Now custom, especially if it date from our childhood, acquires the force of nature, the result being that the mind holds those things with which it was imbued from childhood as firmly as though they were self-evident. It is also a result of failing to distinguish between what is self-evident simply, and that which is self-evident to us. For it is simply self-evident that God is, because the self-same thing which God is his existence. But since we are unable to conceive mentally the self-same thing which is God, that thing remains unknown in regard to us. Thus it is self-evident simply that every whole is greater than its part, but to one who fails to conceive mentally the meaning of a whole, it must needs be unknown. Hence it is that those things which are most evident of all are to the intellect what the sun is to the eye of an owl, as stated in Metaphysics 2. Nor does it follow, as the first argument alleged, that as soon as the meaning of the word God is understood, it is known that God is. First, because it is not known to all, even to those who grant that there is a God, that God is that thing than which no greater can be thought of, since many of the ancients asserted that this world is God. Nor can any such conclusion be gathered from the significations which Damascene assigns to this word God. Secondly, because, granted that everyone understands this word God to signify something than which a greater cannot be thought of, it does not follow that something than which a greater cannot be thought of exists in reality. For we must needs allege a thing in the same way as we allege the signification of its name. Now from the fact that we conceive mentally that which the word God is intended to convey, it does not follow that God is otherwise than in the mind. Wherefore neither will it follow that the thing than which a greater cannot be thought of is otherwise than in the mind. And thence it does not follow that there exists in reality something than which a greater cannot be thought of. Hence this is no argument against those who assert that there is no God, since whatever be granted to exist, whether in reality or in the mind, there is nothing to prevent a person from thinking of something greater, unless he grants that there is in reality something than which a greater cannot be thought of. Again it does not follow, as the second argument pretended, that if it is possible to think that God is not, it is possible to think of something greater than God. For that it be possible to think that he is not on account of the imperfection of his being or the uncertainty thereof, since in itself his being is supremely manifest, but is the result of the weakness of our mind which is able to see him, not in himself but in his effects, so that it is led by reasoning to know that he is. Wherefore the third argument also is solved, for just as it is self-evident to us that a whole is greater than its part, so is it most evident to those who see the very essence of God that God exists, since his essence is his existence. But because we are unable to see his essence, we come to know his existence not in himself but in his effects. The solution to the fourth argument is also clear, for man knows God naturally in the same way as he desires him naturally. Now man desires him naturally in so far as he naturally desires happiness, which is a likeness of the divine goodness. Hence it does not follow that God considered in himself is naturally known to man, but that his likeness is. Wherefore man must needs come by reasoning to know God in the likenesses to him which he discovers in God's effects. It is also easy to reply to the fifth argument, for God is that in which all things are known, not so that other things be unknown except he be known, as happens in self-evident principles, but because all knowledge is caused in us by his outpouring. Chapter 12. Of the opinion of those who say that the existence of God cannot be proved, and that it is held by faith alone. The position that we have taken is also assailed by the opinion of certain others, whereby the efforts of those who endeavor to prove that there is a God would again be rendered futile, for they say that it is impossible by means of the reason to discover that God exists, and that this knowledge is acquired solely by means of faith and revelation. In making this assertion, some were moved by the weakness of the arguments which certain people employed to prove the existence of God. Possibly, however, this error might falsely seek support from the statements of certain philosophers, who show that in God essence and existence are the same, namely that which answers to the question, "What is he?" and that which answers to the question, "Is he?" Now it is impossible by the process of reason to acquire the knowledge of what God is. Wherefore seemingly neither is it possible to prove by reason whether God is. Again, if, as required by the system of the philosopher, in order to prove whether a thing is we must take as principle the signification of its name, and since according to the philosopher, the signification of a name is its definition, there will remain no means of proving the existence of God, seeing that we lack knowledge of the divine essence or quiddity. Again, if the principles of demonstration become known to us originally through the senses, as is proved in the posterior analytics, those things which transcend all sense and sensible objects are seemingly indemonstrable. Now such is the existence of God. Therefore it cannot be demonstrated. The falseness of this opinion is shown to us first by the art of demonstration, which teaches us to conclude causes from effects. Secondly, by the order itself of sciences, for if no substance above sensible substance can be an object of science, there will be no science above physics, as stated in form metaphysics. Thirdly, by the efforts of the philosophers who have endeavored to prove the existence of God. Fourthly, by the apostolic truth which asserts that the invisible things of God are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Nor should we be moved by the consideration that in God essence and existence are the same, as the first argument contended. For this is to be understood of the existence by which God subsists in himself, of which we are ignorant as to what kind of a thing it is, even as we are ignorant of his essence. But it is not to be understood of that existence which is signified by the composition of the mind. For in this way it is possible to prove the existence of God, when our mind is led by demonstrative arguments to form a proposition stating that God is. Moreover, in those arguments whereby we prove the existence of God, it is not necessary that the divine essence or quiddity be employed as the middle term, as the second argument supposed, but instead of the quiddity we take his effects as middle term, as is the case in a posteriori reasoning, and from these effects we take the signification of this word God. For all the divine names are taken either from the remoteness of God's effects from himself, or from some relationship between God and his effects. It is also evident from the fact that, although God transcends all sensibles and senses, his effects from which we take the proof that God exists, are sensible objects. Hence our knowledge, even of things which transcend the senses, originates from the senses. Chapter 13. Arguments in proof of God's existence. Having shown then that it is not futile to endeavor to prove the existence of God, we may proceed to set forth the reasons whereby both philosophers and Catholic doctors have proved that there is a God. In the first place we shall give the arguments by which Aristotle sets out to prove God's existence, and he aims at proving this from the point of view of movement, in two ways. The first way is as follows. Whatever is in motion is moved by another, and it is clear to the sense that something, the sun for instance, is in the motion. Therefore it is set in motion by something else moving it. Now that which moves it is itself either moved or not. If it be not moved, Then the point is proved that we must needs postulate an immovable mover, and this we call God. If, however, it be moved, it is moved by another mover either. Therefore, we must proceed to infinity, or we must come to an immovable mover. But it is not possible to proceed to infinity. Therefore it is necessary to postulate an immovable mover. This argument contains two propositions that need to be proved, namely that whatever is in motion is moved by another, and that it is not possible to proceed to infinity in movers and things moved. The first of these is proved by the philosopher in three ways. First, thus, if a thing moves itself, it must needs have the principle of its movement in itself, else it would clearly be moved by another. Again, it must be moved primarily, that is, it must be moved by reason of itself and not by reason of its part, as an animal is moved by the movement of its foot, for in the latter way not the whole but the part would be moved by itself, and one part by another. Again, it must be divisible and have parts, since whatever is moved is divisible, as is proved in 6 Physics. These things being supposed, he argues as follows: that which is stated to be moved by itself is moved primarily. Therefore, if one of its parts is at rest, it follows that the whole is at rest. For if, while one part is at rest, another of its parts were in motion, the whole itself would not be moved primarily, but its part which is in motion while another is at rest. Now, nothing that is at rest while another is at rest is moved by itself, for that which is at rest has a result of another thing being at rest must needs be in motion as a result of the other's motion, and hence it is not moved by itself. Hence that which was stated to be moved by itself is not moved by itself. Therefore whatever is in motion must needs be moved by another. Nor is this argument reversed by the statement that might be made, that supposing a thing moves itself, it is impossible for a part thereof to be at rest, or again by the statement that to be at rest or in motion does not belong to a part except accidentally, as a vice ne quibbles. Because the force of the argument lies in this, that if a thing moves itself primarily and of itself, not by reason of its parts, it follows that its being moved does not depend on something, whereas with a divisible thing, being moved, like being, depends on its parts, so that it cannot move itself primarily and of itself. Therefore the truth of the conclusion drawn does not require that we suppose as an absolute truth that a part of that which moves itself is at rest, but that this conditional statement be true, that if a part were at rest, the whole would be at rest. Which statement can be true even if the antecedent be false, even as this conditional proposition is true if a man is an ass he is irrational. Secondly, he proves it by induction. Thus, a thing is not moved by itself if it is moved accidentally, since its motion is occasioned by the motion of something else. Nor again if it is moved by force, as is manifest. Nor if it is moved by its nature like those things whose movement proceeds from themselves, such as animals, which clearly are moved by their souls. Nor if it is moved by nature, as heavy and light things are, since these are moved by their generating cause and by that which removes the obstacle to their movement. Now whatsoever things are in motion are moved either per se or accidentally, and if per se, either by force or by nature, and if the latter, either by something in them, as in the case of animals, or not by something in them, as in the case of heavy and light bodies. Therefore whatever is in motion is moved by another. Thirdly, he proves his point thus: nothing is at the same time in act and in potentiality in respect of the same thing. Now whatever is in the motion, as such, is in potentiality, because motion is the act of that which is in potentiality, as such. Whereas whatever moves, as such, is in act, for nothing acts except in so far as it is in act. Therefore nothing is both mover and moved in respect of the same movement. Hence nothing moves itself. We must observe, however, that Plato, who asserted that every mover is moved, employed the term movement in a more general sense than Aristotle. For Aristotle took movement in its strict sense, for the act of a thing that is in potentiality as such, in which sense it applies only to divisible things and bodies, as is proved in 6 Physics. According to Plato, that which moves itself is not a body, for he took movement for any operation, So that to understand or to think is a kind of movement, to which manner of speaking Aristotle alludes in Theoria Anima. In this sense, then, he said that the first mover moves itself, inasmuch as it understands, desires and loves itself. This, in a certain respect, is not in contradiction with the arguments of Aristotle, for it makes no difference whether with Plato we come to a first mover that moves itself, or with Aristotle to something first which is altogether immovable. He proves the other proposition, namely that it is impossible to proceed to infinity in movers and things moved, by three arguments. The first, 48, of these is as follows. If one were to proceed to infinity in movers and things moved, all this infinite number of things would necessarily be bodies, since whatever is moved is divisible and corporeal, as is proved in 6 Physics. Now every body that moves through being moved is moved at the same time as it moves. Therefore all this infinite number of things are moved at the same time as one of them is moved. But one of them, since it is finite, is moved in a finite time. Therefore all this infinite number of things are moved in a finite time. But this is impossible. Therefore it is impossible to proceed to infinity in movers and things moved. That it is impossible for the aforesaid infinite number of things to be moved in a finite time, he proves thus. Mover and moved must needs be simultaneous, and he proves this by induction from each species of movement. But bodies cannot be simultaneous except by continuity or contact. Wherefore since all the aforesaid movers and things moved are bodies, as proved, they must needs be as one movable thing through their continuity or contact. And thus one infinite thing would be moved in a finite time, which is shown to be impossible in 6 Physics. The second argument, 52. In proof of the same statement is as follows. In an ordinate series of movers and things moved, where namely throughout the series one is moved by the other, we must needs find that if the first mover be taken away or cease to move, none of the others will move or be moved, because the first is the cause of movement in all the others. Now if an ordinate series of movers and things moved proceed to infinity, there will be no first mover, but all will be intermediate movers as it were. Therefore it will be impossible for any of them to be moved, and thus nothing in the world will be moved. The third argument, 53, amounts to the same, except that it proceeds in the reverse order, namely by beginning from above, and it is as follows. That which moves instrumentally, cannot move unless there be something that moves principally. But if we proceed to infinity in movers and things moved, they will all be like instrumental movers, because they will be alleged to be moved movers, and there will be nothing by way of principal mover. Therefore nothing will be moved. We have thus clearly proved both statements which were supposed in the first process of demonstration, whereby Aristotle proved the existence of a first immovable mover. The second way is as follows. If every mover is moved, this statement is true either in itself or accidentally. If accidentally, it follows that it is not necessary, for that which is accidentally true is not necessary. Therefore it is a contingent proposition that no mover is moved. But if a mover be not moved, it does not move, as the opponent asserts. Therefore it is contingent that nothing is moved, since, if nothing moves, nothing is moved. Now Aristotle holds this to be impossible, namely, that at any time there be no movement. Therefore the first proposition was not contingent, because a false impossibility does not follow from a false contingency. And therefore this proposition, every mover is moved by another, was not accidentally true. Again, if any two things are found accidentally united in a certain subject, and one of them is to be found without the other, it is probable that the latter can be found without the former. Thus if white and musical are found in Socrates, and musical without white is found in Plato, it is probable that it is possible to find white without musical in some subject. Accordingly if mover and moved be united together in some subject accidentally, and it be found that a certain thing is moved without its being a mover, it is probable that a mover is to be found that is not moved. Nor can one urge against this the case of two things one of which depends on the other, because those in question are united not per se but accidentally. If, however, The aforesaid proposition is true in itself. Again, there follows something impossible or unfitting. For the mover must needs be moved either by the same kind of movement or by another kind. If by the same kind, it follows that whatever causes alteration must itself be altered, and furthermore that the healer must be healed, that the teacher must be taught, and in respect of the same science. But this is impossible, for the teacher must needs have science, while the learner must needs not have it, and thus the same will be both possessed and not possessed by the same, which is impossible. And if it be moved by another kind of movement, so that, to wit, that which causes alteration be moved in respect of place, and that which moves in respect of place be increased, and so on, it will follow that we cannot go on indefinitely, since the genera and species of movement are finite in number. And thus there will be some first mover that is not moved by another, unless, perchance, someone say that a recurrence takes place, in this way, that when all the genera and species of movement have been exhausted, a return must be made to the first. For instance, if that which moves in respect of place be altered, and that which causes alteration be increased, then again that which is increased be moved in respect of place. But the consequence of this will be the same as before, namely, that which moves by one kind of movement is itself moved by the same kind, not immediately indeed but mediately. It remains therefore that we must needs postulate some first mover that is not moved by anything outside itself. Since, however, given that there is a first mover that is not moved by anything outside itself, it does not follow that it is absolutely immovable, Aristotle proceeds further, saying that this may happen in two ways. First, so that this first mover is absolutely immovable, and if this be granted, our point is established, namely that there is a first immovable mover. Secondly, that this first mover is moved by itself, and this seems probable because what is of itself is always prior to what is of another. Wherefore also in things moved, it is logical that what is moved first is moved by itself and not by another. But, if this be granted, the same consequence follows. For it cannot be said that the whole of that which moves itself is moved by its whole self, because then the absurd consequences mentioned above would follow, namely that a person might teach and be taught at the same time, and in like manner as to other kinds of movement, and again that a thing would be at the same time in act and in potentiality, since a mover, as such, is in act, while that which is moved is in potentiality. It remains, therefore, that one part thereof is mover only, and the other part moved. And thus we have the same conclusion as before, namely that there is something that moves and is itself immovable, and it cannot be said that both parts are moved, so that one is moved by the other, nor that one part moves both itself and the other, nor that the whole moves a part, nor that part moves the whole, since the above absurdities would follow, namely that something would both move and be moved by the same kind of movement, and that it would be at the same time in potentiality and in act, and moreover that the whole would move itself not primarily but by reason of its part. It remains, therefore, that in that which moves itself, one part must be immovable, and must move the other part. Since, however, in those things among us which move themselves, namely animals, the part which moves, namely the soul, though immovable of itself, is nevertheless moved accidentally, he goes on to show that in the first mover, the part which moves is not moved neither of itself nor accidentally. For in those things which among us move themselves, namely animals, since they are corruptible, the part which moves is moved accidentally. Now those corruptible things which move themselves must needs be reducible to some first self-mover that is everlasting. Therefore that which moves itself must have a mover, which is moved neither of itself nor accidentally. It is clear that, in accordance with his hypothesis, some self-mover must be everlasting. For if, as he supposes, movement is everlasting, the production of these self-movers that are subject to generation and corruption must be everlasting. But no one of these self-movers, since it does not always exist, can be the cause of this everlastingness. Nor can all of them together, both because they would be infinite, and because they do not exist altogether. It follows therefore that there must be an everlasting self-mover, that causes the everlastingness of generation in these lower self-movers, and thus its mover is not moved, neither of itself nor accidentally. Again, we observe that in self-movers some begin to be moved anew on account of some movement whereby the animal is not moved by itself, for instance by the digestion of food or a change in the atmosphere, by which movement the mover that moves itself is moved accidentally, whence we may gather that no self-mover, whose mover is moved per se or accidentally, is always moved. But the first self-mover is always in motion, else movement could not be everlasting, since every other movement is caused by the movement of the first self-mover. It follows therefore that the first self-mover is moved by a mover who is not moved, neither per se nor accidentally. Nor is this argument rebutted by the fact that the movers of the lower spheres cause an everlasting movement, and yet are said to be moved accidentally, for they are said to be moved accidentally not by reason of themselves, but by reason of the things subject to their motion, which follow the motion of the higher sphere. Since, however, God is not part of a self-mover, Aristotle goes on in his Metaphysics to trace from this motor that is part of a self-mover, another mover altogether separate, which is God. For since every self-mover is moved through its appetite, it follows that the motor that is part of a self-mover moves on account of the appetite for some appetible object. And this object is above the motor in moving, because the appetent is a moved mover, whereas the appetible is a mover altogether unmoved. Therefore there must needs be a first mover separate and altogether immovable, and this is God. Now two things would seem to weaken the above arguments. The first of these is that they proceed from the supposition of the eternity of movement, and among Catholics this is supposed to be false. To this we reply that the most effective way to prove God's existence is from the supposition of the eternity of the world, which being supposed, it seems less manifest that God exists. For if the world and movement had a beginning, it is clear that we must suppose some cause to have produced the world and movement, because whatever becomes anew must take its origin from some cause of its becoming, since nothing evolves itself from potentiality to act, or from non-being to being. The second is that the aforesaid arguments suppose that the first moved thing, namely the heavenly body, has its motive principle in itself, whence it follows that it is animated, and by many this is not granted. To this we reply that if the first mover is not supposed to have its motive principle in itself, it follows that it is immediately moved by something altogether immovable. Hence also Aristotle draws this conclusion with an alternative, namely that either we must come at once to a first mover immovable and separate, or to a self-mover from which again we come to a first mover immovable and separate. The philosopher proceeds in a different way in two Metaphysics, to show that it is impossible to proceed to infinity in efficient causes, and that we must come to one first cause, and this we call God. This is how he proceeds. In all efficient causes following in order, the first is the cause of the intermediate cause, and the intermediate is the cause of the ultimate, whether the intermediate be one or several. Now if the cause be removed, that which it causes is removed. Therefore if we remove the first, the intermediate cannot be a cause. But if we go on to infinity in efficient causes, no cause will be first. Therefore all the others which are intermediate will be removed. Now this is clearly false. Therefore we must suppose the existence of a first efficient cause, and this is God. Another reason can be drawn from the words of Aristotle, for in two Metaphysics, he shows that those things which excel as true excel as beings, and in four Metaphysics, he shows that there is something supremely true, from the fact that we see that of two false things one is falser than the other, wherefore it follows that one also is truer than the other. Now this is by reason of approximation to that which is simply and supremely true. Wherefore we may further conclude that there is something that is supremely being, and this we call God. Another argument in support of this conclusion is adduced by Damascene, from the government of things, and the same reasoning is indicated by the commentator in 2 Physics. It runs as follows: it is impossible for contrary and discordant things to accord in one order always or frequently except by someone's governance, whereby each and all are made to tend to a definite end. Now we see that in the world things of different natures accord in one order, not seldom and fortuitously, but always or for the most part. Therefore it follows that there is someone by whose providence the world is governed, and this we God. Chapter 14. That in order to acquire knowledge of God it is necessary to proceed by the way of remotion. Accordingly, having proved that there is a first being which we call God, it behoves us to inquire into his nature. Now in treating of the divine essence, the principal method to be followed is that of remotion, for the divine essence by its immensity surpasses every form to which our intellect reaches, and thus we cannot apprehend it by knowing what it is. But we have some knowledge thereof by knowing what it is not, and we shall approach all the nearer to the knowledge thereof according as we shall be enabled to remove by our intellect a greater number of things therefrom. For the more completely we see how a thing differs from others, the more perfectly we know it, since each thing has in itself its own being distinct from all other things. Wherefore when we know the definition of a thing, first we place it in a genus, whereby we know in general what it is, and afterwards we add differences, so as to mark its distinction from other things, and thus we arrive at the complete knowledge of a thing's essence. Since, however, we are unable in treating of the divine essence to take what has a genus, nor can we express its distinction from other things by affirmative differences, we must needs express it by negative differences. Now just as in affirmative differences one restricts another, and brings us the nearer to a complete description of the thing, according as it makes it to differ from more things, so one negative difference is restricted by another that marks a distinction from more things. Thus, if we say that God is not an accident, we thereby distinguish him from all accidents. Then if we add that he is not a body, we shall distinguish him also from certain substances, and thus in gradation he will be differentiated by such like negations from all beside himself. And then when he is known as distinct from all things, we shall arrive at a proper consideration of him. It will not, however, be perfect, because we shall not know what he is in himself. Wherefore in order to proceed about the knowledge of God by the way of remotion, let us take as principle that which is already made manifest by what we have said above, namely that God is altogether unchangeable. This is also confirmed by the authority of Holy Writ. For it is said, I am God and I change not, with whom there is no change, and God is not as a man, that he should be changed. Chapter 15. That God is eternal. From the foregoing it is also clear that God is eternal, for whatever begins or ceases to be, suffers this through movement or change. Now it has been shown, that God is altogether unchangeable. Therefore he is eternal, having neither beginning nor end. Again, only things which are moved are measured by time, because time is the measure of movement, as stated in 4 Physics. Now God is absolutely without movement, as we have already proved. Therefore we cannot mark before and after in him. Therefore in him there is not being after non-being, nor can he have non-being after being, nor is it possible to find any succession in his being, because these things cannot be understood apart from time. Therefore he is without beginning and end, and has all his being simultaneously, and in this consists the notion of eternity. Moreover, if anyone he was not and afterwards was, he was brought by someone out of non-being into being, not by himself, because what is not cannot do anything, and if by another, this other is prior to him. Now it has been shown, that God is the first cause, therefore he did not begin to be. Therefore neither will he cease to be, because that which always was, has the power to be always. Therefore he is eternal. Furthermore, we observe that in the world there are certain things which can be and not be, namely those that are subject to generation and corruption. Now whatsoever is possible to be has a cause, because, as in itself it is equally related to two things, namely being and not being, it follows that if it acquires being, this is the result of some cause. But, as proved above, by error is Tottel's argument, we cannot go on to infinity in causes. Therefore we must suppose something, which it is necessary to be. Now every necessary thing either has a cause of its necessity from without, or has no such cause, but is necessary of itself. But we cannot go on to infinity in necessary things that have causes of their necessity from without. Therefore we must suppose some first necessary thing which is necessary of itself, and this is God, since He is the first cause, as proved above. Therefore God is eternal, since whatever is necessary of itself is eternal. Again, Aristotle proves the everlastingness of movement from the everlastingness of time, and thence he goes on to prove the everlastingness of the substance that is the cause of movement. Now the first moving substance is God, therefore He is everlasting. And supposing the everlastingness of time and movement to be denied, there still remains the argument in proof of the everlastingness of substance. For if movement had a beginning, it must have had its beginning from some mover. And if this mover had a beginning, it had its beginning from some agent. And thus either we shall go on to infinity, or we shall come to something without a beginning. Divine authority bears witness to this truth, wherefore the psalm reads, "But Thou, O Lord, endurest forever," and again, "But Thou art always the self-same, and Thy years shall not fail."